Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM in Johnson City. She's watching the detectives. You know, I love detective movies, those old film noirs from the 40s, the black and white, the Venetian blinds, the light, the shadow, the femme fatale, the detective in his office with his fedora. Those are wonderful films, and today we're going to tell you some detective stories. Today's stories begin, as is so often the case, with a woman. Her name is Meg Kennedy, and she's the director of museum programs at Montpelier. And all that sounds so academic and so dry, it's anything but. In fact, as Meg told me during a recent visit, most of her work is, in fact, detective work. You see, one of her main jobs is to repopulate the mansion at Montpelier with, ideally, actual pieces of furniture and decoration that the Madisons had themselves, or failing that, a reasonable facsimile from that period of time, or failing that, a reproduction of some sort so that visitors like us can go into the mansion and have some sense of what the Madisons did. But her detective tale spans the globe. And today I'm going to share with you my conversation with Meg Kennedy.
I am the acting director of museum programs, and I work with our curatorial and research groups, particularly on furnishing what was a fairly empty, restored home in recent years, but also producing the historical and academic scholarship on the Madisons, on life at Montpelier.
So you're in charge of the stuff I see in the Montpelier blogs, too?
Yes, my group writes many of those, though we split responsibilities with our archaeology crew.
Right, I've noticed that there's an archaeology blog, and there's the general Montpelier blog, and there's several specialized blogs, the constitutional blog and all the rest of it, and you're sort of in charge of much of that then.
Yeah, we put together content usually based on projects we're working on, some of which seems cutting edge that we may have been working on behind the scenes for a couple of months, or sometimes about topics we're just learning about.
And they are excellent topics, and it's excellent blog. I'm not much
Thank
of a
you.
Blog reader myself, but I really will say that. In fact, I'm going to confess right here now to everyone in the whole world that I often steal items from your blogs for our Madison Minute.
Oh, good.
On the show. Well, I'm glad you like that, because I'm going to do it anyway. No, there's always a fascinating tidbit, a fascinating story, and I know that it's well researched and authoritative, and so it's a very good thing. So those who are particularly interested in the Madisons or in Montpelier would—that's right on Montpelier.org, right?
Correct, Montpelier.org/blog.
Slash blog, okay. And so you've mentioned your group. Well, how many people are in your group?
We have a group right now of 8, I believe, and we have been as large as 15. Full-time staff with a rotating group of many consultants who bring subject matter expertise to our research projects.
Okay, so you'll have a particular project you need done, so you'll bring in somebody who knows about that and
exactly.
a period of time. Okay, that's
exactly.
cool. You also mentioned at the outset of this that you buy the furniture. that is a cool job to have. I mean, there are lots of people out there who'd like to go furniture shopping, but you're going for very specific furniture shopping, aren't you?
We are. We put a great deal of pressure on ourselves to be as accurate as possible in our acquisition. We consider this acquiring, not buying.
Well, of course. But of course you have to pay somebody at
some
point.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. There's some buying involved as well. But let's put this in context. I mean, Montpelier only opened up to the public a few years ago, right?
Correct.
Okay, and it went under after the DuPonts gave it to the National Trust. Mm-hmm. And the Montpelier Foundation took over, there was an enormous renovation that went on.
Correct. And some of your listeners may have visited even before the restoration began, when it was still the DuPont House. But
right.
we also were open.
Guess who did that too? I did that.
Did you?
In the
Great.
First, I don't even know why I was here, but for some reason I was driving by and I said, Montpelier, I know what that is. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I was looking at all this DuPont stuff. And it was actually, the whole place was torn up. It was in the midst of everything.
Sure.
I remember the Red Room.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly, with all the horse stuff in it. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking to myself, man, these people have their work cut out for them. But then once all of that renovation, the physical renovation done, and all the archaeology and all the preparation, then you were left with more or less an empty house, right?
Correct.
And that's where you came in, right?
Exactly. In 2008, the mansion reopened as it looked in the Madison's retirement era. So we focus specifically on the period between 1817 and 1836, when Madison had retired from public office and returned home to spend his final years at Montpelier. That's a period in which his mother also lived in the house, though she maintained separate quarters, essentially, on one side. So we are working on a few core rooms now, but we are trying to replicate Madison's house as it would have looked then.
Okay, let me have one preliminary question. Do you actually try to find original Madison
pieces?
Yes,
absolutely.
Okay, and those have scattered to the four winds, right?
Correct. We absolutely prioritize original Madison pieces. Because Montpelier was only open to the general public in the late 1980s, and we really only started the project I currently work on within the last decade, Madison objects over the 20th century scattered. They're around the world. There are pieces in Hawaii. There are pieces in Europe. And our main objective is to track down those items.
This sounds like detective work then.
Exactly. We call it the presidential detective story.
The presidential? That's cool. Cool. Now, how does one find a Madison piece?
We receive calls from the public, some of whom believe they have inherited a piece that has Madison provenance, usually carries a story that it descended through their family, and somehow is related to James or Dolly. That it isn't always the case, so some of what we do is break bad news to people who might have very significant pieces, just not pieces connected to James and Dolly Madison.
Mm-hmm. Well, man, that sounds like a bad episode of the Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we're sorry, but this piece is only worth $10 because it wasn't owned by James Madison, but by John Madison, who has no connection to the...
Exactly.
Oh, that's too bad. All right.
Though we are interested in the Madison family more generally, too. So we take great interest when there are other family members' objects that come up. We are also simultaneously doing a major research project to track all of the extant Madison documents. So they're somewhere in the high 20,000 amount of materials. We've been using a relational database to make sense of these documents, to essentially catalog and track object mentions throughout the Madison's lifetime. And so
if Madison wrote a letter to somebody and said, oh, by the way, I just bought a new cabinet and I put it up in my map room.
That's exactly right.
Oh, okay, something like that.
Exactly.
And now you know there was a cabinet there.
Correct.
And maybe he described it, and that helps you figure out what you need.
Exactly. So we track these conjectural objects, which we know the Madisons had, but we might not have one in front of us today. And so when people call in or when we hear about an item in someone's attic, we can start to make sense of the context of those objects, if it would have belonged in the Madison's household. And we also, in this detective work, are able to rule out more modern pieces. So even something that's very unique and significant from the late 19th century was not used by James and Dolly Madison.
Right. Now, do you feel like you've got a fairly comprehensive view of most of the objects that were in the house during this period, or are you still working on developing that comprehensive database? I imagine that's part one of the first steps, isn't it? It's just to say, what was here? Why, you know, how many objects? What were they? And then you can start looking for them. Is that the approach?
Exactly. I never thought that when I became a historian, I would spend most of my day in a database, but that is the bulk of what we do, work in this database.
Do you have, like, blueprints of the house and, you know, little pictures? Okay, you do? Okay.
Yeah, we're tracking. These are the initial steps toward a furnishing plan for the entire house.
Right.
Now, right now, when people come visit, they'll notice that there are certain core rooms we've focused on. Those are the rooms that most visitors during the period that we're studying, Madison's retirement, most visitors went into those spaces. So they often wrote home, kept a diary entry, somehow described those spaces. And they are much easier for us to work on furnishing at this point because we have documentation to suggest what was in the spaces. Unfortunately, Madison was not the best record keeper of these sorts of things. Unlike his friend down the road, Thomas Jefferson, he didn't give us very clear blueprints for what was in his home.
Right. And if visitors weren't there, for example, I'm guessing if a visitor didn't go into Madison's own bedchamber.
Correct. Exactly.
Then there was no one writing about what was in there. You know, he didn't write a letter to Dolly saying, you know, I really like where you put your hairbrush. You know, it just doesn't happen.
Exactly.
So those must be the really hard ones, right?
Exactly. The easier rooms are what we consider the public rooms during this time period. The drawing room, where most visitors were welcomed to the house. The dining room, where many people visited, and the room in which Madison died, where he spent his final decade of life essentially bound in bed. Even though that in some ways was like a bedchamber, it also existed as a public space. Mm-hmm. For invited guests.
That's where he would sit at his own table, and they'd open up the dividing door, and he
exactly.
could talk to people. Right, okay, yeah. I talked to John Jeans. He took
yes.
me through the house a few months ago, and he explained how that worked out. And I noticed at the time that it was sort of partially furnished, but since I was there, I think that room has been fully furnished mm-hmm. now, or fairly fully.
Yeah, we opened it as a refurnished space for the anniversary of Madison's birthday this March. 2012.
Great. Now tell me, what is the coolest Madison artifact you've ever tracked down, or the coolest detective story? What's your favorite? The favorite object that you've recovered that's an original Madison piece?
I don't even know that I have an answer to that.
You don't have a favorite? You don't have a favorite? Surely there must be just this one particular piece that's particularly beautiful, or it came to you in a strange way. Something of that sort?
I will confess that my bias is as a documentary historian, mm-hmm. and I am much more thrilled by our documents. I find...
So you're actually collecting documents just for themselves, not
yes.
just as clues for furniture.
Correct.
And so you want the originals here?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, are you actually constructing an archive?
We are. We have a small archive right now. We have a fairly comprehensive archive of the DuPont materials. Mm-hmm. But our Madison collection is small but growing. But even if we don't collect those documents, we are excited that other institutions have them. And we recognize very clearly that because we are new to collecting Madison pieces, we owe a great deal of respect to the institutions who acquired those objects in the last 150 years and have safeguarded them.
Mm-hmm.
And in some instances, we are aware that we can't have an original piece here in our own collection, but have been granted an opportunity to reproduce the piece from the owning institution.
Mm-hmm.
And so visitors will notice that, particularly in the drawing room, some of the original busts that were in Madison's collection have very fine homes of their own now, mm-hmm. and we've done.
They're impressive busts, by the way. I mean,
yes.
These are big. I mean, these
yes.
are, you know, they're life size or bigger. It seems
correct.
To me.
They're intended to be a likeness, a representation of colleagues, friends, political counterpoints, and inspiring figures in Madison's life, and. They are the sort of pieces that other institutions easily collected over the years.
Sure they would. And now, are most of these other institutions museums, or are they private collections?
What? In terms of the bust, they are typically in other museums and library collections.
So what you've got are reproductions then?
Yes,
now,
in some cases. We do have originals as well in the house right now, but in the case of... certain busts where they are already safely in other collections, we went through a process of digitally scanning them with laser technology and reproducing them in plaster. So
that is so cool. I was thinking you'd actually have to take the bust and immerse it in some sort of plaster to make a mold. But you didn't have to do that. You could take a digital representation and then feed it into a computer, and that created the mold to make a plaster bust.
Exactly.
I had no idea that such technology was available.
And it's also much safer for the original.
Well, I imagine, yeah. You don't have to put a bunch of goop on the original.
Yeah, you never have to touch the original.
Oh, then I imagine that makes them much more willing to allow.
Exactly.
Yeah, the people who own it now, if you can say, we're not even going to touch it. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. And the busts are particularly special, I think, because visitors recognize them and discuss them at length. We have many visitor accounts that talk about the collection of likenesses.
You mean 18th
likenesses.
Century and 19th century
Correct.
Visitors?
Correct, yes. Who were visiting Madison, waiting for him to come collect them in the drawing room.
Sure, what else would you do? I mean, you're waiting for the president to show up. You're going to walk over and look at the pictures and look at the bus, and then you're going to write home to your wife about it or
exactly.
your husband. Right, okay.
One such visitor referred to the room as having more of the appearance of a museum.
It does. And, you know, in fact, I'm going to congratulate you now that I'm speaking to the person who's in charge of that process, because that is a very impressive room. And that was pretty much, I think, in its final form when I saw it a few months ago. I mean, mm-hmm. that one was finished early, right?
Yes. There are still some projects we're working on in that room. For instance, we know that there were very large pier glass mirrors mm-hmm. on either side of...
Pier glass. What's a pier glass mirror?
To peer into a looking glass.
Oh, okay.
So, mirrors.
Okay. Mirrors, okay. That's what they call them, pier glass mirrors.
Yes,
okay.
exactly. Large and as cheap as can be bought per Dolly's request in one of the letters, which will fit on either side of the central door to the room.
And those are not in place yet?
They're not in place. So.
Okay, have you found something or found a reproduction or nothing?
We are yet? In the midst of the detective story. Mm-hmm. So... Hopefully, next time we talk, there will be mirrors found and in place.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. Now, I guess, the priority is to get the original piece. So mm-hmm. if you were actually able to find somebody who had one or two of these mirrors, mm-hmm. those would be what you wanted.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if you don't have that, or even if you do have that and the people aren't willing to part with them, then it's a matter of trying to reproduce something that's as close to that as possible.
Correct.
Put it in the right position. And John Jeans was telling me before that, I mean, you're literally going back and looking to see where the nail holes mm-hmm. were.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That room has its original plaster, which is an enormous gift to us now in the refurnishing effort, because we understand very clearly where pieces were hung in that room. Mm-hmm. And there was... earlier in the project, we thought that there were likely sconces on the walls mm-hmm. or shelves that held up bust reductions, small pieces. And we learned, because there is the original plaster, that there was no architectural evidence to support a sconce or those small shelves. So we know very clearly where the mirrors hung and approximately what size they were, given the nail hole evidence.
Yeah, you could actually deduce something from the position and the size of the hole and all the rest mm-hmm. of it. I mean, a little tiny hole would indicate a smaller mirror, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm, exactly. Or more nails to suggest they were supporting more weight.
More weight, right. Yeah, this really is detective work.
Mm-hmm.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking today with the acting director of museum programs at Montpelier. Her name is Meg Kennedy, and it turns out that much of her job is just one great big detective story. It's a global hunt for pieces of furniture and other artifacts to put into the mansion at Montpelier. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and rejoin our detective story with Meg Kennedy. Stay tuned. Now it's time again for our constitutional quiz, and this time it's a little bit different because our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael, has now become the quiz mom. Well, Kelly Carmichael, live from maternity leave, how are you?
I'm well, how are you, Stuart?
Doing extremely well indeed, but despite your delicate condition, I understand that you've gotten a really good quiz question for us today.
Motherhood does not stop the constitutional quizzes.
It does not. The quiz must go on. All right, what's your question? What's your question this week?
Sure. The question is about naturalized citizens.
Naturalized citizens, okay.
All right, so just essentially naturalized citizens. A, do not have the right to vote. B, are required to learn and speak English. C, cannot serve as president of the United States. Or D, are born on United States soil.
Wow. Okay. Once again, just so that our contestant can make sure that he's heard all of the various options.
Sure thing. Naturalized citizens, A, do not have the right to vote.
Okay.
B, are required to learn and speak English. C, cannot serve as president of the United States. Or D, are born on United States soil.
All right. Now on the line we have Victoria. And Victoria, where are you from?
I am from Sevierville, Tennessee.
Sevierville, Tennessee. Sounds like a very stern place.
It is actually a very fun place to live. We have a lot of fun there.
A lot of fun in Sevierville. And who's that town named after?
The town is named after John Sevier. He was the first governor of Tennessee.
Correct, but you get nothing for answering that correct. That's not the quiz question. But,
Gosh darn.
But you're on a roll, so let's see how you do with the one that Kelly gave us. It's about naturalized citizens, and let's go through the answer choices one by one. I think A was that naturalized citizens cannot vote. What do you think about that one?
I'm thinking that naturalized citizens are allowed to vote.
Okay. What about B, then? Required to learn and speak English?
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure that they're not actually required to learn English. So I'm thinking that one's not right either.
That one's not right either. Okay, what about C? You like C?
I do like C for this answer. I don't believe they're permitted to serve as president of the United States.
All right, yeah. Answer choice C says they cannot serve as the president. That doesn't seem fair. Okay, but that's the one you like. Okay.
That's what I'm thinking.
What about D before we finish? The naturalized citizens are born on U.S. soil?
No, that doesn't sound right either. I'm thinking it's C.
You're thinking it's C, and I'm not going to dissuade you?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, let's go to Kelly and ask her what the correct answer is.
The answer is C. Naturalized citizens cannot serve as president of the United States.
Cannot serve as president of the United States. So you mean that Arnold can't be president?
It is true. Arnold could not be president.
I can be the governor, but I cannot be the president. Yes, all right, all right. Well, that's a pity because, you know, I think he'd make a fantastic president, especially for all those, you know, this terrorist war-fighting parts of the job. But, okay, thanks, Kelly. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You know, all kidding aside, Kelly, this is a significant issue, and I've spoken with people who find this to be a very troubling clause. No one's entirely sure why it was included in Article 2. I mean, it's probably just xenophobia. It's probably just concern about foreigners. But isn't that interesting that people would be concerned about foreigners having the highest office in our land when at that time, back in 1787, most of the people in the United States
were brand new.
I mean, either they were born elsewhere and came over. Many members of the convention themselves have been born overseas. And certainly most of them were not that many generations in the United States.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that has a practical problem today. I mean, not just Arnold Schwarzenegger of California, but Jennifer Granholm of Michigan, a recent Democratic governor, is Canadian, or what started life as a Canadian. And so even though she's had, by all accounts, very distinguished service and would otherwise be a potential candidate for president, maybe our first woman president, she is constitutionally disqualified. Now, there is an argument that the Equal Protection Clause has effectively amended Article 2. And so, you know, maybe one day we'll get somebody challenging this, and maybe they will be elected despite having been born overseas. But at the moment, just reading the text of Article 2 says if you weren't born here, you can't be president.
True indeed, Stuart.
Well, Victoria, none of that matters to you. All that really matters is that you get a T-shirt.
That's right.
Okay, well, congratulations and thanks for playing.
Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And now let's continue my discussion with Meg Kennedy, the acting director of museum programs at Montpelier. Meg's been telling me about the sorts of evidence that she looks for and that she sometimes finds that help her figure out whether a certain piece of furniture or a certain piece of decoration is really and truly a Madison piece.
We have similar evidence in many of the rooms for carpet tacking. Mm-hmm. That tell us if the Madisons made seasonal changes in their flooring, if they stretched a carpet all the way across, if they used a floor cloth.
Right. And
so we spend a lot of our time looking at the evidence from the architectural restoration. That is, along with the original Madison documents, the second most important component of our research project.
Very cool. Now, if you had to take a guess, or maybe you've got a particular figure on this, percentage-wise, how much of the furnishing do you think you have either acquired originals with or are accurate reproductions? Are we at a third or a half or a quarter?
In terms of the whole house?
Yeah, the whole house.
You know, it feels to me like we're just at the beginning of this process. There are still some rooms we don't know a lot about, especially these private rooms like the bed chambers. So it's very hard to say. We know that it was a packed full house, especially during the Madison's retirement when he and Dolly had accumulated a lifetime's worth of possessions, his mother in the same position on her side of the house. So I think we are only scratching the surface.
Oh, man, I shudder to think what my house will look like when I'm old enough to retire, and especially if my mom comes to live with me. It would be stacked to the ceilings.
Exactly.
So that's the kind of house it was then.
Mm-hmm. There are visitor accounts that talk about the drawing room being just chock full, crammed in every corner with objects. And we only have today, and there are 10 French chairs. We know that there were 18 that were upholstered to match the curtains, along with 2 settees. Now, we are not in a position to furnish it as fully as possible because we also want there to be space for visitors to enjoy themselves and learn about the Madisons.
Sure, yeah. It sounds to me like I hope we're not discovering that the Madisons were hoarders. But they were obviously putting together a house not for tours. They were putting together a house to live in and, you know, to entertain in. So I can see that eventually as you get closer and closer to achieving your goal of historical accuracy, you might have to make some compromises in terms of just getting people in and out
exactly.
of the house. Yeah, but at the moment, there's still a sense that you've got a lot of space left, but I guess that's going to diminish.
Which means
time.
We have a lot of work left to do.
Sounds to me like you've got employment here for the next several decades.
Let's hope.
Yeah, exactly right. You mentioned documents that there are your particular interest. Is there a particular document that you have found particularly interesting or a particularly good find or one that was a surprise to you?
You know, we're still holding out hope that somewhere in someone's attic, in a chest, hidden away, there is a day book for the house. We don't have any.
What is a day book?
Something that the principal homekeeper of the house, in this case Dolly, possibly Nellie Madison, Madison's mother, would have kept that instructed the domestic servants, the enslaved domestic servants in the household, on everyday life, records that indicate what they were purchasing or their routine maintenance schedules. There are not many of these that survive for other housekeepers, though we have some evidence in other homes have good evidence.
This would be sort of just I guess I'd never thought about this since I've never owned a mansion and I've never had a staff, but you don't simply want to say to the staff, do this, do that. You want it to be written down. So either the Madisons themselves would write something down or they would the servants would take notes.
Exactly.
And put them down and keep track of what they spent money on and how much they spent and what they acquired and what their orders were. So is that what we're talking
about?
Yeah,
that's exactly right. And the Madisons were gone from Montpelier for great stretches of time through most of his career. They were in Philadelphia when he was in Congress. Mm-hmm. And then for 16 years in Washington when he was Secretary of State and later 2 terms as president. And so we know that there must have been documents on how to maintain the household.
Oh, yeah, there must have been. It must have been letters. And I imagine when they got a letter from Madison, they would save it, you know, to refer to it. And he might want to look at it and make sure the things he'd asked to be done had been done. Well, that's just fascinating, and that would be nice. And so if anybody thinks he's got the day book, that's the holy grail, is it?
Yes, please contact me. That would be wonderful. And those documents also would shed greater light on everyday life in the house. Mm-hmm. We know a lot more about special occasions. We know actually quite a lot about the Madisons' life at the president's house, what they called the White House, or they called the White House the president's house. Because there are better federal records for their accounts, what they were spending money on, particularly through the president's furnishing fund. Mm-hmm. And so we know the sorts of materials that were being used every day in the house, brooms and certain cloths and what textiles they were buying that were not intended to be used for clothing or upholstery. And that gives us a better sense of what real life was like there day in and day out. And right now we don't have the same wealth of documents for the Madisons at Montpelier. Mm-hmm.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Meg Kennedy, the acting director of museum programs at Montpelier. She's been telling me about the detective work that goes into her job, which is largely involves finding pieces of furniture and other items to put in the mansion at Montpelier. Now, here comes a really cool part. After we had our discussion in Lewis Hall at the Center for the Constitution, we walked over and went to the mansion, and the first place we stopped was Mr. Madison's library.
This is part of the wing addition to the house that was built during Madison's presidency, we believe between 1809 and 1812. And it's a very private space. As we walked in here, you noticed we walked past a pantry and through a hallway that has stairs down to the kitchen in the cellars. And we think, based on the lack of visitor descriptions of this room, that it was a fairly private space. We don't know all that much about how
it was used.
Right,
and because it was private, and then that's where you have the difficulty figuring out what to put in here.
Exactly.
But I see nonetheless that there is a lot of furniture, so could you describe some of it and whether it's original or whether it's reproduction?
Yeah, of course.
And how you got it?
I think anyone who's studied Madison understands that he was a scholar and an owner of many, many books. And we know from some of the period visitor accounts that he had thousands of books stacked everywhere in any corner. And so in his late retirement, we believe he had three rooms that were devoted to library spaces. Mm-hmm. So we get a good sense that it should be crammed full of books, as many as possible. And we've been collecting, if possible, Madison's original books, mm-hmm. though many of them were dispersed through the 19th century when his stepson Payne Todd sold them following President Madison and Dolly's deaths. Mm. And some others were destroyed in the fire at the Rotunda at the University of Virginia just in the 1890s.
That's so sad. So a lot of Jefferson's books and a lot of Madison's mm-hmm. books were destroyed after they'd been put there for safekeeping. I'm so sorry to hear about that.
Exactly. The library there has been very conscientious about acquiring the original volumes that were recorded. So we have a good sense of what was in that collection. And today we're doing the same sort of project. We're tracking all references to books in Madison's papers and letters, his receipts. Particularly good receipt is a shipment Jefferson sent to Madison while Jefferson was in France in mm-hmm. the 1780s, books that Madison used when he was working on what became the Virginia Plan mm-hmm. prior right. to the Constitutional Convention. So we are actively attempting to acquire books that would have been in Madison's collection or those that were. We also have in this room many maps. We know now that Madison had an extensive map collection. We think probably 200 maps. As someone who didn't travel, maps were really the way that Madison understood the world.
Sure.
Especially as Secretary of State.
There was no National Geographic Channel then. There was no Smithsonian Channel. So if you wanted to think about where you were on the globe, well, you needed a globe.
Yeah,
and I see you have one there.
We have a terrestrial and a celestial globe.
Mm.
These are based on 1825 Cary globes, printed in London.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Madison was fond of the study of geography.
Yeah, well, I see a lot of the maps around here. I'm a map guy myself. I see there's one of the United States. I see one of Mexico.
Exactly.
I see one of the East Coast. And, of course, I see one of Virginia itself, which at that time included West Virginia.
Exactly. That was done by Bishop James Madison, President Madison's cousin, who was the president of the College of William and Mary. Mm-hmm. And we know that it held a place of prominence in Madison's collection. We also have interesting pieces, dissected maps.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one that we can actually touch. It's a reproduction.
Okay, well, you can touch. I'm not gonna cross the line here.
I'll allow you to touch it briefly. Madison had a collection of what were called dissected maps, maps printed on paper, then cut into segments and pasted or glued onto linen so that they could be folded.
Yeah, just like modern maps, except exactly. That with the linen, they're not going to crease and fall apart the same way, or at least not as quickly as, you know, one piece of paper folded up.
Exactly, and they were often stored in boxes, like one you see on the table mm-hmm. here, or some were small enough to fit into a pocket, mm-hmm. so they could be used for traveling as well. This is a skull map of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. We know Madison had at least one copy of this.
All right. Now, what else am I looking at here? Is there any original piece in here? Or these are all reproductions or facsimiles?
No, there are original pieces in
okay.
here. Though, a good story to tell you, we thought that one of the bookshelves in this room was an original piece. It had great Montpelier provenance. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until we took it away from the walls and were inspecting it, looked on the back, and saw small saw marks that are characteristic of the 1840s.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
Just after Madison's death. So the shelf most likely was here at Montpelier, though as a possession of the subsequent owner.
Oh, I see.
But we have...
What we call a near miss, an almost.
Exactly.
Okay.
There are a number of period pieces in the room, not all Madison's, but that describe the period to our visitors. And we have some of Madison's original books. Mm-hmm. On the shelves and on the mantle. And we also have a bust that you see, William Irving.
Now, forgive my ignorance. Who was William Irving?
He was a diplomat, in mm-hmm. A colleague of Madison's. And he sent a great letter to Dolly asking that she display his likeness in Mr. Madison's library.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Meg Kennedy, who's the Acting Director of Museum Programs at Montpelier, and we've just been on a tour of the mansion, specifically Mr. Madison's library, which has to be one of my favorite rooms in the whole house. After the break, we'll come back and we'll finish our discussion with Meg, and the next place we're going to go is, well, you'll just have to come back and find out for yourself. It's your weekly Constitutional, and we're learning all about the detective work that goes into finding and acquiring pieces of old furniture and other decorations at the mansion at Montpelier. We're speaking to Meg Kennedy, and next we're going into M200.
We are in a bedchamber on the second floor. We refer to it internally as M200.
M200,
for
okay.
lack of a better name at this point. But we're in the addition that was added to the house in the late 1790s, 1797. And we believe this was likely used as a bedroom for Dolly's son, Madison's stepson, Payne Todd, when they first moved back here.
Mm-hmm.
He was a child growing up in this house. And we're in the smaller of the two bedchambers
okay.
that were added at that point.
Now, the last time I was here, I believe that those walls were all bare, weren't they?
Mm.
Or you could see the lath and all the rest
I'm
of
sure
it?
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably true.
Okay.
They now contain have a distemper on them, typical of what Dolly favored throughout mm-hmm. this side of the house. And this room is used now as both curatorial storage, but also as a way for us to bring visitors who take our behind-the-scenes tours into a space to see what curators do here. At
that means you folks, we're all behind the scenes. Isn't it exciting? We get to go into the places nobody else gets to go because we're special.
That's right.
Okay.
By appointment, you're also welcome to schedule a tour with one of the curators, and we'll take you through here and talk more about the presidential detective story, how we understand objects, how we date them, the sorts of details that we're looking for, and talk you through the process when we do reproduce objects.
Well, there are a lot of objects in this room, and are these in sort of the process of being assimilated into the mansion? Is that what's going on?
Yep, exactly. Okay. And some are pieces we have vetted and now understand them to not be appropriate for use in the mansion, but in some cases have significance in and of themselves and are worth display and would be interesting to visitors and scholars of decorative arts.
Well, it's interesting. Now, if you had a piece like that, in fact, is there one that you can point out here we can just use as a reference point?
Sure. Okay. We have a grandfather clock, an impressive tall case clock in the corner of the room.
It's very pretty.
Yeah, it's a wonderful piece. And unfortunately, it's not the Madisons. And we actually know quite a bit about the grandfather clock that was used in the house during the Madisons' occupancy.
Okay, now with this one, did you acquire it thinking that it might be the Madisons, and then you got it here and you figured out after looking at it that it wasn't? Is that the process?
Exactly.
Okay, so there's always some disappointment, I'm sure, when you get to the point where, oh, there's that saw mark, or there's that type of tack, or there, here's a little label or something that indicates. Okay. But now you say, okay, well, it's in, for lack of a better term, it's a reject. It's, you know, did you send it off to the Isle of Misfit Toys? I mean, is it, or are you going to keep it here? Are you going to send it to some museum where it's more appropriate?
I think so. We'll probably have it go to a better home where they can display it more prominently. But for now, it is a wonderful piece that many of our visitors are interested in. And because we don't have the Madisons' grandfather clock, this gives us an opportunity to talk about what we do know was here.
Mm-hmm.
We know that in James Madison Sr.'s will, that's President Madison's father, in his will, he left the grandfather clock to stay in the house, in Madison's mother's side of the house. We know that it was made in Virginia, but that it likely had English works. And we have a fairly good sense, based on other pieces made in the period, especially those manufactured in Fredericksburg, a major mercantile center for the Madisons during this period, what the clock would have looked like.
And so it looked something like that, I'm guessing.
Yes. But we are still in our quest to find, hopefully, the original Madison grandfather clock, but if not, a piece that is more similar to it, to those descriptions.
Now, if that's one that's on its way out, show me something or point out something, if you would please, that's on its way in, that you think is probably the original piece or something close enough that you want to use it here in the mansion.
Well, we are looking at pieces of the dining room table that are going to be installed fairly soon. There you see demi-lune pairs on either side of the room.
And okay, for the guys among us who don't know what a demi-moon is, this is a table that it looks like a half moon when it's put up against the wall, but then you pull it out from the wall and you could actually fold up a leaf, right? And
exactly.
Make it into a larger serving table or maybe even a place for extra guests to sit or something.
Exactly.
Okay.
And
right.
It is married with a piece in the center to make it even larger.
Well, of course, actually, you could do that. You could take the two halves and put them together and make it into another dining room table. Yeah, well, that's actually pretty ingenious. Okay.
And they also act as nice console tables in the meantime.
By the way, I didn't mean to be sexist. I know that some guys know all about demi-moons and some women don't. So, you know, I have no idea. Okay, go on. So that one that you think is actually going to make it in here, right?
Yes, yes. We have plans to install it soon.
And it's going to be in the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool.
And probably covered in cloth.
Covered in cloth? You mean like just a tablecloth on it?
Okay, exactly, right. As it would have been for the Madisons.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't catch. Did you tell me, is that original or is it a good reproduction? Or
it's a period piece. It's in very good shape, and we do not believe it was the Madisons.
Okay, so it's from that era, so it is an old original table, but it's not original to the Madisons, but it's good enough for now until the real one shows up.
Exactly.
Okay, got it.
Exactly. The other thing that I think is important to talk about in this room is our process for reproducing our busts. And we've been talking about that in other spaces. And here you can see our prototypes. prototypes that lead to plaster reproductions, and these, you saw the final form of these in the drawing room mm-hmm. this morning. But you can see our stage of reproducing here.
This is the
Cardelli bust of Madison.
The Cardelli bust of Madison. Okay, and this is just what, plaster?
This is a plastic. You can hear.
Oh yeah.
Nails against it.
Right.
Plastic reproduction based on the laser scan.
So that's the first thing you get from the laser scan.
Exactly.
Okay, so you scan the thing with a laser. You then put it into some sort of plastic molding machine or something, right? Mm-hmm. And this is what comes out. You get the plastic mold or plastic bust of Madison. So now you got a really good idea what it looks like, but it's just gray plastic. Okay.
Exactly. And you can see the remnants of plaster here where they made the reverse.
Right, the reverse
for a mold.
Right.
And then if we walk to the other side of the room, we can see one of the prototypes. This is plaster,
mm-hmm.
first run through the mold.
Right.
And this Cardelli bust of Madison reproduction was rejected in part because the it's not as crisp as it could have been. And if you put the plastic prototype next to this first run of the plaster, you can notice that the pieces of his hair are not as well defined.
Mm-hmm.
His features are softer
mm-hmm.
than they are in the original bust.
Okay.
And so we use this to first as a plaster bust that can be touched and
mm-hmm.
moved, but also to show the process.
Very cool. Alrighty, very interesting. Now you got all these old busts around, so I mean, do you just like give them away? I mean, can I take one with me?
We only have these two.
Oh, that's a pity. I thought maybe there's just a bunch sitting in a back room someplace. That would look pretty cool in my office, but we'll have to wait for another day for that.
We'll negotiate.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking to Meg Kennedy about the fascinating detective work she does, repopulating the mansion at Montpelier with all sorts of interesting and historic artifacts. We've just been to the nerve center of that process, the secret room on the second floor, M200. But now let's go to what many people find the most poignant and the most interesting room in the entire mansion.
We refer to this room as Mr. Madison's room because period visitors also called it that. It was we believe it began as a back parlor
mm-hmm.
in the Madison's home and later became the principal room that Madison occupied in his retirement,
mm-hmm.
where he worked, but also where he recovered from illness.
Mm-hmm.
It is adjacent to the dining room, and there are wonderful stories about servants, the enslaved domestic servants, opening the door to the
mm-hmm.
dining room and allowing Madison to participate still in the conversation happening at the dining room.
Yeah, let's try to get that down. I mean, the dining room that we've already described is in the front of the house,
mm-hmm.
and it looks, you know, like a dining room. It's a big room, has table in it and all the rest of that stuff. But then there is a connecting door to this back parlor, as you say. And the back parlor is, what, about 10, 15 feet wide and maybe 20, 25 feet long, roughly
mm-hmm.
rectangular with a fireplace at one end. And you could see it being used as a parlor. But the modern day equivalent, this is where you put grandma, or this is where you put, you know, a grandfather who no longer gets around very
mm-hmm.
well. I mean, many people still to this day will do that to a room in their house.
Mm-hmm.
And this was Mr. Madison's room when he had difficulty moving around, going up and down the mm-hmm. stairs. And so this was the center of his life for the last few years of it, right?
That's exactly right.
In fact, there's a bed. I mean, I guess he slept here, and he had his easy chair here. He had his table there where his meals were brought to him. He had his fold-out desk, all the rest of it. So this was really was the center.
Exactly. His manservant, enslaved
domestic
servant, Paul Jennings,
mm-hmm.
who was the first memoirist of the White House,
mm-hmm.
Recalls being with Madison in this room in his final years, shaving him
mm-hmm.
in here, feeding him breakfast. And this is the room in which Paul Jennings describes Madison dying.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. In fact, he had just finished it, or he was just about to sit down to his breakfast, and you've got the table set as if it would be set for breakfast.
Exactly.
So this is probably a reasonable facsimile of what the room looked like on the day that James Madison passed away.
Mm.
That's poignant. Very poignant room. Okay, anything else in particular you want to discuss in here about the furniture or any original pieces here?
The desk that you see here, we believe was Madison's or was at Montpelier,
really?
May have been used by Dolly,
mm-hmm.
And was actually used at Montpelier by Marion Dupont Scott, who preserved it through most of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
We also have, Stuart, you mentioned that the table is set for breakfast or tea.
Mm-hmm.
The set that you see there, the porcelain, is Daggety, by the manufacturer Daggety. It's French. And that is part of the set that our archaeologists find shards of.
Oh, really?
In the archaeological record outside.
Okay, so they found pieces of that, and they were able to clean them off and look at them and say, oh, okay, it's this pattern, it's this type. And so then they were able to extrapolate from that and say, well, then this would have been the set.
Exactly. And this set still belongs to descendants of Dolly Madison. It's in their family collection, and it's on loan to us.
We think these are original then?
Yeah, these absolutely.
Oh, so it's not merely reproducing them. So all the pieces there, I see there are, what, 3 or 4 teacups, and then there's a creamer, and there's a sugar bowl, and help me, there's what, a teapot and a coffee pot.
Okay, exactly.
Right. And they're actually quite pretty, and very, very, and those are original. Wow, that's nice.
And the bed, in this case, is a late 18th century piece. It's not Madison's, though it's as close as we were able to get based on the descriptions of Madison's bed. It's a lit a la Polonaise, a bed in the Polish style.
Okay.
Very popular in France at the late 18th century. And we know from great records that Madison had his Polonaise bed shipped from France through James Monroe, who was serving in a diplomatic capacity in France just following the Revolution, French Revolution, and he sent Madison a bed to suit Madison's new situation, his marriage to Dolly.
Well, you know, and I can see it is technically a double bed, and I know that Madison was a short man and a slight man, and I guess Dolly was not that much bigger than he was, but nonetheless, it looks like a very cozy bed. Most of us would probably describe it today as maybe a single and a half or a small double. And of course, like many beds of that period, it was also shorter than the ones we have today, or at least it looks like it might be a little bit shorter. But that belies the grandness of it. I mean, it's a four-poster, and it's got this great big drape across the top of it. I'm sure you can give a better description of it than I can, but it's actually rather a grand-looking bed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There's a crown draped in crimson damask, as visitors described the bed in this room, supported by iron stretchers. And these curtains could be closed to provide warmth or darkness, protection from insects. And we believe this bed was likely used during the day as Madison was propped up working in especially his final years when he and Dolly were editing his papers.
Yeah, the notes on the convention, yeah.
Exactly.
So a lot of that happened here. A lot of the editing of the notes of the Constitutional Convention happened in this room, too. Well, this is, in its own way, as significant as the upstairs library is, which is, of course, where Madison, we think, you know, came up with her Virginia plan. This is, you know, that was the beginning of the process, and this was really sort of the end of the process as far as Madison himself and Dolly were concerned. So another very important room in the house. And as you pointed out before, since it connects to the dining room, Madison, they could move his chair, and they could put the chair right in front of the door here and open it up, and then he could converse with people in the dining room without actually having even to walk over there. He sounds like he wasn't very mobile at all in those last years.
That's right, and we know that he also entertained visitors in this space.
Okay, so they would actually
guests,
come in here.
Yeah, which is why we have great descriptions of it. Mm-hmm. People describe what was on the walls, the bed in great detail, far more than visitors describe any of the bed chambers.
Well, you mentioned the walls. I see there are several pieces here. Do you want to describe any of them?
Sure.
Okay.
In particular, we have 6 framed colored engravings done by the naturalist Buffon. Madison went through a period in the 1780s where he was very interested in Buffon's work on animals and natural history.
Now, these look like very accurate depictions. I see they've got a bison there. They've got a camel. They've got a wolf?
Yep.
Okay. And then over there, it looks like a big brown bear and an elephant and lion.
That's right. Madison wrote to Jefferson when Jefferson was serving in France and asked if it was possible to buy colored Buffon engravings because he thought that if framed, they would make a nice display on a wall.
Indeed they do. Very nice. Now, in the middle of all this, middle of these six, we have a map of Washington, D.C., I'm guessing as it existed roughly at this time. The date on here is what? MDCCC? I guess that's 1800? Is that what that is? Must be, yeah. 1500. Yeah. Okay. 1800, and then it says 1792. Is it actually... Well, I can't really read it very carefully from up here. Roughly 1800, I'm guessing. Okay.
Yep, and this is Ellicott's plan for the city of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Depicts a lot of places the Madisons later became very familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Lafayette Square,
mm-hmm.
President's House, Capitol Building, and looks much like Washington today.
Yeah, it does. It looks very, very much like Washington does today. I think part of the Potomac River has been filled in since then, mm-hmm. Especially where the Lincoln Memorial now sits, and the western part of the mall was apparently part of the Potomac River back then, or at least the mudflats near the Potomac.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some significant changes, but it's very much recognizable, especially, as you say, the area between the Capitol and the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very nice. Okay, and I see there's another print over here. That's a familiar scene. And this looks like the Declaration of Independence.
This is Duran's engraving of the Declaration of Independence, an image that's very familiar mm-hmm. to most Americans
today.
Oh, yes,
today. Yes. We've all seen this.
We know that Madison depicted the Declaration in a number of ways throughout the house. He also had John Binns's engraved Declaration of Independence print in the drawing room, prominently displayed over the mantle.
Mm-hmm.
But in this room, he chose Duran's, shows the work, the process of the
right, and there's signing. There's the drafting committee standing up in front of the table, and I'm guessing that's Hancock sitting, you know, facing them. Yep, very familiar and very lifelike. In fact, it looks almost photographic. It's a very good reproduction. Or is this an original engraving here, I guess?
This is a reproduction in this case.
But it's very, very good. Well, our detective story with Meg Kennedy is almost over, but guess what? You can help, and here's how.
I hope that anyone who has clues about the Madisons or life at Montpelier will absolutely be in touch with me or our assistant curators. And
What is your email address here?
My email address is mkennedy, K-E-N-N-E-D-Y, at montpelier.org.
If anyone even thinks that he or she knows about a Montpelier piece, or Madison piece, I should say, they should send an email to you.
Correct. And I should also say at the very tail end of this that Marion DuPont Scott, the 20th century primary owner of the property, actually was one of the best stewards of Madison pieces. Many people came to Montpelier with pieces that they felt had Madison provenance, and Marion DuPont Scott collected those. And so we would like to continue the tradition being like Marion DuPont Scott and accepting Madison pieces, and also thank her for the legacy of collecting and stewardship.
Well, Meg Kennedy, thank you very, very kindly. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Stuart.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Acting Director of Museum Programs Meg Kennedy at Montpelier and her fascinating detective stories. I just love this episode. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your constitution, and you need to learn about it.
She's watching the detectives. Jumping.